You have a new additional printout today. I've been handing out for many weeks now Romans 1:21, Romans 1:22. Today I've added Romans 1:23, but it's in the context of the King James that I've put up on the right side. This entire section of Romans has one simple message. God's been making His presence known. Theologians distinguish between general revelation and special revelation. That which is available to all in the handiwork of God and the creation, and that which is special, the oracle of God. They even have a nice, neat little theological way of saying it. The eternal Word became the incarnate living Word to become the spoken Word, to become the written Word, to become the implanted Word, to become the engrafted Word, which moves us toward incarnating that same nature from glory to glory, so it returns to the eternal level. But I'm not willing to be that strict. I think God has special ways of dealing outside this special Word that we respect and live to proclaim. I referenced in an earlier message the little book, Eternity in Their Hearts, where a missionary was surprised to find when he got to a native village that was apparently never exposed to the Christian message. But he was met by an elder of the tribe that had received some special message in a vision that God was sending a man to give him light. We don't know the ways of God. In fact, the greatest message, the greatest text as a foundation of faith may be the one uttered by a heathen prophet. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? Numbers 23:19. That was a heathen prophet. Whatever the spectrum, God is revealing in these verses that He has made His presence known. And furthermore, by implication, He has placed inside mankind a capacity to see. We have an English word we don't often stop to think about. Insight. What's the matter with sight? Why, insight. We all know what sight is. Sight is seeing. We can even describe it now that you are scientific experts with photons and rods and cones and... Why do we have this word insight? One of those words that's hard to translate, because it carries with it a plethora of intuitive understanding. You can have a mass of people that have sight, but people that have insight, those are the ones you want to listen to. It is a sight beyond just light rays and responses and feed to the brain. Insight. God is making it clear in the verses we just covered that there is given to all men some kind of insight. What about this chosen for the world, reformed and called, and out from among those not called? Right. Don't ask me to explain how God, who is the Alpha and Omega, knows the future, knows who, and yet they're still held guilty. These are the oldest debates of the church. How can God hold us accountable for something that He already knew we were going to do? If we don't have freedom, how? We do have freedom. That's where I differ from the great reformer Luther. The self, and I spent a whole year on that little circle of the self and its nature. I'm with the Niebuhrian, neo-orthodox group, that no activity of man is ever done without that measure of freedom having a part which makes it, in that measure, from our side of the ledger, unpredictable. Because God gave that as part of the image of God He put in man. He gave away something that He has. He gave a part of Himself, including a measure of freedom. Because without it, there's no love. Love is non-existent without it being freely given. Trust, mechanized dependability, is not trust. And that's why I've preached faithfully through the years that the root of sin is that passage in the Old Testament, all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to our own way. Misuse of freedom. God said, let us make man in our image. And He gave to them that capacity that could become responsible use of freedom. God free to do what He wants, including spitting us out. God's not made to be faithful. There's not some intrinsic quality in God that prevents Him from being unfaithful. He is faithful. He is that He is. As He said to Moses, I am that I am. Have you ever paused long enough to say, why didn't you just say I am? I am that I am. He chooses to be what He is. The hippies, as I've said to you 1,000 times, were all wrong when they said God is love. No, He's not. Love is a quality of God, intrinsically and inseparable from His nature. Wherever you encounter Him, He's a loving God, but He is not. Turn it around. Love is not God. If love were God, He'd be dead. Love is not God. If He were love, Satan would have overpowered Him. What makes God God is His power. If He ain't on top, somebody else will be. There's only one absolute, essential criteria for a God who is. Oh, a God that we create is one that we like. So we spin out our fabric of who God is. But if He is, that which makes Him God is all power. And that's what God's mad about. That He hurls this universe into the spaces, creates all of this for us. And created us for Him. And we cannot look at the imprint of His presence and recognize His divine power. that only a God could do it. And we've looked at the ridiculous concepts. When you go into the microscopic world, some murky, primeval soup with particles jumping in and out, unable to be located and measured at the same time. And to the macro world, where 90% of it is dark matter that we don't know what it is and can't see. And yet it all hangs together with such a delicate balance that I never have gotten to reading about 2 pages of what just any imbalance would do to destroy life on this. And I did give you the statistics of what it would take to produce a star coming out of a Big Bang, without which there'd be no life. This whole fabric woven, God's PO'd. He's fed up. He's left the imprint of His presence, and He gave to every person the capacity of insightful recognition. And when you yield to that which makes us all sinners, all we like sheep have gone astray, we've turned everyone to our own way. I repeat it now about the 20th time. R.C. Sproul has said an atheist is an atheist not because the facts have convinced him. He has produced the facts to go along with his psychological state, which is he doesn't want a master. God requires the bended knee. God, if He exists, even as scientists would recognize, if we could conceive, even in measures, such a being as an almighty, all-powerful God who created it all, you cannot do anything other than sing, "How great Thou art." That's what they don't want to do. They want the world to sing how great You are to them. And what Paul is saying in this verse, through the inspiration of God, is that if you do not act on the knowledge you have, starting with an ignorant native who has nothing but the heavens to look at night, and the sun in its regularity, and the earth in its abundance, to fail to recognize God's reality, His power, and give Him thanksgiving, that's the dream, or not the dream, the insight that came. Open the day with prayer. Begin not with worry, but with praise. Failure to recognize God's presence and His hand in the creation. For an ignorant native is to have God turn on him and take away from him this capacity of insight, until the result is what Romans 1:22 declares, and I'll read it in the King James, because that when, verse 21, they knew God, don't say they don't. I carry trunkloads of books stacking up their various theories, all of which are designed to rule out as a possibility that God did it. Anything but God. Anything but faith. And I've been spending weeks now showing you that what they want substituted in the place of faith in God is faith in their theory unproven. And God is fed up. Because when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became, and I went through the words, the tiles, evil in their self-deceit, and in their imagination, no dialogues, using of words to support their evil, self-aggrandizing theories and opposition to God. That God, then it says, their foolish heart was darkened, but as you have seen in the previous weeks, sense is taken from them. They are rendered senseless in that dimension of their mind that gives them the capacity of insight and seeing God. This was prefaced by the wrath of God is being revealed now. Oh, you have any trouble convincing people that maybe they ought to give thought to the fact that when you cross the great divide, there might be two different doors, figuratively, a heaven and a hell. And if you don't want to even deal with hell, you might miss heaven. Future. No, that's not what Paul's talking about. I've already covered the Greek in the previous verses. It is right now. A God who is full of wrath and pouring it out right now. And the wrath is specifically and precisely this. Don't forget about it, but for the moment, shove where it is to the future, the ultimate damnation. We're talking about a wrath of God that's working right here and now. You get cavalier. You get casual. You let your self-centered ways make you to continue to ignore and fail to act on the knowledge that God has given you. He will take away from you the capacity to see Him if He's standing in front of you. If He's blocking the door you're going through, He's taking from you now. And I've said it week after week as we've camped out on this verse. If that's what God will do to people who will not act in recognition of His presence, thanksgiving of what He has done for them, act in trust of such a one that could create such as this and place us the center of it, if He can get that mad that He withdraws the capacity to see Him from those that only have the creation, how much more those that have imbibed the full brightness of His light and still play intellectual games because at your heart and will you are not willing to face the cross and simply make Him the center of your life instead of still believing the garbage of most of Christianity that you can make God bend to you as the center of His life. That's what these verses are about, and that's why God has camped out. To whom much is given, much is required. I could take you into Hosea, that Old Testament prophet, chapter 4. Increased in knowledge and failure to recognize Him, therefore He will take it from them and their children. And what they become with the insight removed is what the 23rd verse or 22nd verse says, professing themselves to be wise, the Greek word from which we get sophisticated, sophomore, sophist, professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. But I've also, in your previous handouts, know that the cognate, it's the Greek word from which we get moron. Professing themselves to wise in their dialogues and explanations of why God can't be part of the equation, they become morons. And that's what I've been trying to demonstrate for these several messages. That Nobel Prize winners, Nobel candidates, most of whom can be traced to a point where they turned from God and ruled Him out of the equation. Darwin would never really become outspoken in his atheism because of his Christian wife. Stephen Hawking tread softly in declaring. That's why you find in his books humorous, flippant remarks about God. Because he didn't want to offend his dedicated Christian wife. And I told you the story when he was 13 years old with two of his friends in the Billy Graham Crusade in London. He chose not to convert. The two friends did. And his confession is very clear as he explains reality without God. If I can explain it and understand it, I feel I'm somehow the master of it. That's R.C. Sproul's condition of atheism. But I've been on this, and I'm sure that you're sitting there, many of you, and saying, oh, it sure is true. These are a bunch of geniuses turned waterheads when they get on the subject of ultimate truth. We have shown how evolution has become a religion based on a faith. Faith in at least two things. A great amount of time which requires this earth to be 4.6 billion years old. And uniformitarianism, which means that everything has always stayed the same. And the key to the past is the present. And what's happening now is the way it's always happened. And it's become a religion. You have to take that for granted. And that's why they bought into uranium radioactive dating, because that's the oldest one. Half-life. Half-life gives us the age of the earth. But we have shown that there's some other things going on, and we've been lied to about radioactive dating because there's some dating going on other than the decay dating. And I've covered that, so I don't want to repeat it again. We went over it in detail to show that they try to make, they never date the process. There is no such thing as dating the process. They date the results left after the process works. And only if you take in faith the premise that all this radioactive material started, lead, the uranium that becomes lead, 238 that becomes 206, and that you can tell the difference in the rocks of the earth between ordinary lead, 204, and radiogenic daughter lead, from decay of uranium. Only if it's always been the same, and when half of the original 238 uranium turns into 206 lead, or 232 thorium turns into 208 lead, only if that's the only way you can get the radiogenic daughters, is the half-life accurate. But as I pointed out, the Nobel nominee Melvin Cook discovered there is some Playboy stuff going on. Some loose neutrons that are turning 206 into 207 and 207 into 208. So there's another random buildup of what's supposed to be the results of decay only, that throw it all out the window. I showed you the same with carbon-14 dating. Oh, it must always be, since the earth is 4.6 billion years old, and it takes 30,000 years to get, just take my word for it that that's what they say, and you can read all these books you want, that they've answered the stability problem, because radiocarbon dating assumes that 1 trillionth, they have the machines to measure this. Carbon, one of the most plentiful things in the atmosphere. Carbon-12 and carbon-14, depending upon the extra neutrons that go around the proton, or the joint of the proton, the electron goes around. Neutrons. You add up protons, neutrons, electrons. Carbon-12, 6 and 6 and 6. Carbon-14, 6 and 8. Now that is not your normal carbon. It's caused because cosmic rays hit the atmosphere, hit nitrogen 14, and suddenly we got carbon 14 being formed. And in the atmosphere and in all living things. Now, in the dating periods now, present key to the past, 1/1,000,000,000 of the carbon is carbon 14. The rest of it is carbon 12. Now they can measure it. The thing that makes it a dating technique is it's always the same. Always the same. In the air, and it comes into the plants make their own food with photosynthesis, and then it goes into the food chain, and we eat vegetables and eat the meat from animals that ate it, and as long as you're living, you've got the same balance in your body of carbon 12 and carbon 14 that's in the atmosphere. But when you die, the minute you die, or the minute a plant dies, the minute an animal dies, the minute a tree dies, carbon 14 starts decaying. So the balance changes. And in 5,700 years, half of the carbon 14 will be gone. And another 5,007 years, half more. 11,400 years, another half is gone. So you only got 25% of what you had when you started. Now this assumes, number one, in faith, that the atmosphere has always been the same. That the balance of 1/1,000,000,000 to 1 has always been the same. Therefore, the atmosphere that was breathed by a dinosaur or by a fossilized tree trunk or some piece of papyrus, that the same balance was in the air then when this form of life died as now. Otherwise, it don't work. I mean, if there was less carbon 14 10,000 years ago in the atmosphere, which there would have been if the Pasadena scientists just proved that there was a canopy before the flood. Or if there was an anomaly anywhere, out of normal, pockets somewhere, where there was less carbon 14 in the air, then you start out at your moment of death older than anybody else. Because it's the results. So when you find something dead, if it had less carbon 14 to start with, and you're only using one measuring scale, then it looks older than it is. But there's another anomaly that I told you and ended with, and why I'm on it again today. The man who started carbon 14 dating and discovered it, he assumed that because the Earth is, faith now, 4.6 billion years old, therefore the necessary number of 30 to 50,000 years for the atmosphere to stabilize and decay match input would have happened enough times that in 4.6 billion years, 30 to 50,000 is nothing. So carbon 14 is good up to those 50,000 years and half-lives. Then it gets as small as essentially unmeasurable. Therefore, he assumed a stable atmosphere through the history of mankind, that it's always been the same as it is now. But he discovered something else. That in the atmosphere, there was a buildup of carbon 14, 25% more than decay was eradicated. So there was a 25% factor of an ever-increasing carbon 14 buildup. Now we're talking 1/1,000,000,000, so it takes a lot of years for it to make a difference. But in this 1/1,000,000,000 of the carbon atmosphere, 25% differential. Instead of stable carbon 14 coming and going at the same rate and always remaining 1/1,000,000,000, he was finding a gradual buildup of carbon 14 in the atmosphere of 25%. Am I boring you? We've been over this, but I want to point something out because insight will hit you. He thought that was error. He wrote it down to experimental error. Subsequent experiments proved not only 25%, 38. You got problems back there, so if you're restless and need to go somewhere, go. But I'm having a little too much movement right back here because I want you to listen. Don't disturb people anywhere. Clear? It's been a long service. You know where I go as soon as I leave the platform? Now, are you with me? Not in the same place, I hope. You go that way and I go this way. Listen to me. Not 25%, 38%. That there's a gradual change in the stable condition that this so-called 1/1,000,000,000th carbon-14 is increasing at the rate of 25 to 38%. What next? Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that if carbon-14 has been increasing at 25 to 38%, there's much more carbon-14 in the air atmosphere that starts the process today than there was 50,000 years ago. So that means that something 10,000 years ago is lessened in its carbon-14 ratio by 10,000 years of reverse 38%. There's been a 25 to 38% buildup, then the carbon-14 of the one that died 10,000 years ago may be lower than one that's been dead for 5,000 years. Do you follow that? If the ratio were, as they say, always the same, carbon-12 and carbon-14, 1/1,000,000,000th. If it was always the same, so you have the atmosphere like this, and then when you die, your carbon content is like that, and then this starts to go in half-lives, down and less and less and less, so over here, you got less and less and less of that. Well, now, if 10,000 years ago, there was already a lot less carbon-14, you're starting out much older. When you die, you're older than other people that have been dead 10,000 years. You follow that? I'm supposed to believe all this stuff. I don't mind them giving me the theory. It's an interesting way, and it may work under controlled circumstances for a limited period of time. For success, probably, if we go back to a 3,000 years, then you made that, you got that clear. I want to go to the verses of the day so I can bring us out of this review and start moving on. We have covered enough science to give me a pain in the head. What have these scientists done, as they will explain, anything literally command me as the price of respectable intelligence to accept their faith with the same inquisition mentality that the church gave against scientists in the Middle Ages? Scientism takes that view today. If you don't accept hook, line, and sinker, their theories as fact. I'm supposed to believe that a 55-million-year-old fossil on charts I told you about the sea coelacanth, a fish caught in time, a whole book about it. It's for the coelacanth. Here's the headline when some fishermen off the coast of Africa, Madagascar, blue, one of the prize icons of evolutionary theory, a 55 million year old fossilized, long gone in the chain of fossilized evolution fish, coelacanth, was caught off the coast of Madagascar. Get in close enough to get that headline. That's the newspaper. You're not getting it right. This is the page. You see the fish? Drop the phone number. See the fish? And the headline, Eastern Province Herald, 1939, a living fossil caught in the sea. Best fish story in 50 million years. One of the most sensational scientific discoveries of the century. East London's wonder specimen crawled. We have seen that the Miller-Urey experiment of how life was formed out of some primordial soup that shows up in the Disney film as the way life began. And you can buy back there icons of evolution. We have seen the Miller-Urey experiment supposedly creating an atmosphere from which life would come. Now, of course, we're told in one frame of reference that things must have always been the same. Otherwise, the dating method doesn't work. But the way it all started had to be different. Because the Miller-Urey experiment that's in every textbook, they allegedly in a test tube recreated the early atmosphere, and then to take the place of lightning that might have ignited life, they sent electric spark in. But of course, because it had methane and other explosive gases, they had to take all of the oxygen out. Now, of course, the pictures and the brief comments and textbooks don't point out that if the atmosphere had been as it is now, when they let that electric spark hit the test tube, it had been the last day they ever lived on this earth. So we are now asked to believe things have always been the same, except the way they started couldn't have been the same because it had blown up. Theories. We have the icons of human development, and we've analyzed the Piltdown man, the fraud, and the worker man in the so-called KBS Tough in Turkana, or Turkanu as it is. They've renamed it. It used to be Lake Rudolph, where the leakies work. And you got four layers like a four-story apartment. You got four layers of volcanic ash, and then in between sedimentary rocks. And they use the potassium argon method of dating it, and they come up with 2.6 million years, and then they find man at 2.6 million years old, and all the evolutionary people get upset because man can't be that old because it would upset their little chain of evolution. And somebody else finds in similar tuff an elephant, a fossil, another one finds a pig, and they actually get in fights as they go to the science, one wearing a pig protection hat. Another one is wearing a pin, MCP, for male chauvinist pig, which is really Latin words that say the pigs were there first and not the elephants, as they are trying from fossils to change the date. And they end up doing potassium argon dating that is between 0.5 million years and 17.5 million years. And they choose and fight over 2.8 and 1.6 and end up with 1.88 because that matches the fossil tree that they've worked out. It's all the dating game. It's all smoke and glass and mirrors. I don't care. You want to work card tricks on me? Just tell me what you're doing. I don't even care if they want to say, well, you got to have faith. Because faith is the substance of things hoped for. I hope there'll be no oxygen in this experiment. And the evidence of things not seen. And if they haven't got the oxygen out, there'll be the evidence of things not seen. In all the years since Darwin, they can't find the missing link, and they think they have a fish that crawls out on the shore, and they have the missing link between fish and mammals, and that's 55 million years ago, and they found the link, and then they catch him off the shores of Madagascar. And I told you last Sunday, they used potassium-argon dating for a rock painting found in the bush of South Africa, it's alleged. Thousands of years old. And when they're heralding it as a scientific discovery, I think it's Joan Ahrens, her name, an art teacher in South Africa, saw and recognized it as one of her rock paintings in an art class that was stolen from her garden. So the thousands of years dissolved into a few years ago when it was stolen. We got in the 1800 volcano in Hawaii that's dated, multiplied millions of years by the potassium argon method and fission track method. And it would happen in 1801. And I have trouble with the leaky experiments and the tuff at Lake Turkana, or Turkuna, or whatever it is, and what it was always called previously, Lake Rudolph, because it's the only place that volcanic ash is named after a woman. K. Behrensmeyer site is what KCBS tough means. And this, as I read from the newspaper, they just found another skull or something that's established at 2.6 million years old. No, it isn't. I suggest you get hold of the book, Bones of Contention. Bones of Contention by Marvin Lubinow. I'm about done. Bones of Contention. And the last appendix is The Dating Game, in which he shows the arguments over the dating of this so-called KBS. I sort of like that. KBS, Behrensmeyer site, tough for volcanic ash. It was laid down. It wasn't just sprayed out by a volcano. It was laid down by watershed settling into lakes. And they have now proven, as they've continued to test all the theories and gone on, that some kind of interference, either new volcanic activity or heat, has fixed or ameliorated at 1.8 million a layer below what's laid on top of it, that's now agreed to be was agreed at the time to be 2.6 million. When we read in the Times a few weeks back about the leaky woman finding this new specimen, and they say, absolutely, it's this old, proven, as Richard Leakey said when it first happened. This is found beneath layers that are proven to be such and such and such and such. And now we find out that beneath the so-called 2.6 million, we've got other layers that were altered completely at 1.8 million. I brought a newspaper here. They had some feathered dinosaur in the newspaper this past week. The so-called link between birds and dinosaurs. And I went through that little scene with you. How did flight start? From the ground up, so you have long-legged hopping dinosaurs that eventually leap high enough and flap a little and they can fly. Or the flight ground down. And there you got the four-legged ones that try to jump and glide, and eventually there's things developed between their arms. And then because birds and dinosaurs have the common characteristic of running on two legs, therefore, birds are card-carrying dinosaurs. And therefore, what is a similarity in traits is twisted into an absolute sequence in time. And since they got 4.6 billion that they proved with erroneous methods to work on, now all of these, they're always looking for these missing links, but they can't ever find them. They can't ever find them. And I have back there for you to buy, because I'm coming to the point of leaving this subject and moving on, Icons of Evolution, a good choice of title that blows apart the Miller-Urey experiment, shows the groundless basis of the reptile to bird. And seldom do you hear of controversies like this funny little book called The Bone Hunter's Revenge. And this tells the story of the competition between Marsh and his contemporary, Cope, who really did the most work, ultimately, to Como Bluffs in Wyoming, of uncovering the dinosaurs and the Badlands in the Dakotas, and pioneered as leading paleontologist at the turn of the century. Oh, earlier than that, way back in the early 1800s. And they're famed because the New York Herald carried the fight and the arguments between Marsh and Cope, who were fighting over personal reputation and notoriety in the finds and naming of these things. And that scoundrel that ran the Herald, talk about R.C. Sproul's characterization that made it front page news for months in New York. Used to ride his carriage naked around the streets of New York, and once, to get attention, urinated in the fireplace of a socialite at one of the big parties in New York. I mean, these are real character people, as I told you. Nobody tells you. Let a preacher make a mistake, front page for months. Nobody tells you about Einstein breaking his wife's heart, living with the next woman he married before he left, his first wife. I'm not their judge. I just got the guts to talk back when they set themselves up as judge of religious men and women. I'm tired of their tactics of intimidation. I'm tired of airheads acting like they're intelligent, and we that recognize the reality of God and can sing how great thou art are looked on as mental midgets. Stanford's still number one, and like Paul who said, if there's a fool around, and there's plenty of them, it's time for me to play the fool. Pharisee of the Pharisee I am. Stanford's still number one. PhD from Stanford still sells. Philosophy hasn't changed much. Kierkegaard, Plato, and Aristotle still saying what they said when I was there. They're long dead. They're fossils. I lost my faith over this kind of intimidation. I remembered being chilled when the head of the English department came out of a Moody Bible Institute film and I heard him ranting and raving on the sidewalk, "Faith! Faith! I hate faith!" Well, I wonder if he got up in the morning and worried of whether or not his feet would hit the floor instead of the ceiling. That's faith. Faith in gravity. As I taught you last Sunday, these people require action based upon belief in their theory and confidence to sustain acting on it when I've spent weeks and there are books galore on it poking holes in their theory, and they don't even tell you it's a theory. They say it's a fact. Well, what about us? And what have they done? I'm sure you've read this chapter for years, and you've said, oh, how terrible. What did they do? Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory. Instead of singing, how great thou art, change the glory of the uncorruptible God. And that word, by the way, is non-dying. A non-dying God and a non-decaying God into an image made. Look at the Greek. Into a likeness. Homoiomati. That's a copy. Unto a copy of an image, iconos, a copy of an icon. An icon is an idol. An icon. Jesus is the icon of God eternal. Both Colossians and many other passages speak of Him being made in the express image of God. He is the eternal icon. The express, the proof coin, as Hebrews 1 says, the perfect image struck. He is an icon of God eternal. You see me, you see the Father. They don't want to accept and get in the frame out of the first century to 21st century Romans. The attitude is the same whether you are immersed in special revelation or whether or not you're an ignorant savage that is only exposed to the general revelation. God holds you accountable for the knowledge you have, as He will make clear in the second chapter. And the fool that these people become is to project a copy, which if you trace the word, homoiomati, can be a mental image as well as a formed copy of an icon. Something you put in the place of God, includes you, your family, or whatever. And you always read this and you see natives around, carved images. An image of birds, of corruptible man, and birds, and quadrupeds, and reptiles. The King James says it a little differently. That's why this book needs to be put in context. These people that have professed to be wise and become morons are asking us to accept icons of man forming through this primitive route, which is their creation of the explanation. They're asking us to accept icons . You know that no scientist that you've ever met, and I doubt anybody out there, has ever seen a human fossilized skull or a human fossil. What you see are copies made. They're so rare. Archaeopteryx. You heard about this flying horse. This bird fossil. And we had it in the USA Today, another one of these feathered dinosaurs. And I talked to you about Bambiraptor, the feathered, but the one that for years was an icon beyond belief is this Archaeopteryx, or whatever you call it, Archaeopteryx. It was the most precious. I got to read it here to you, and I'm done. To paleontologist Pat Shipman, it's more than the world's most beautiful fossil. It's an icon, a holy relic of the past that has become a powerful symbol of the evolutionary process itself. It is the first bird. To museum curators, Wright, paleontologists Lowell Dingus and Timothy Rowe, I could do something with Lowell Dingus. The name Archaeopteryx, rings like that of a Rembrandt, Stradivarius, or Michelangelo. In the words of ornithologist Alan Fiducia, the Berlin Archaeopteryx may well be the most important natural history specimen in existence. In vaults, icons. That's what your kids are being asked to worship at. They're being asked to worship these icons, these lies, these evil, self-deceived dialogues of projections of replacements for God, the icons of evolution. And if you don't have that faith, you can't even get a university post. Or you'll be harassed the whole time you're there. You don't get government grants. They teach it in the schools and disallow God being mentioned. I fought against a school engineered and a school written prayer, but it's gone too far. I wonder if somebody's going to file a Supreme Court case when the bullets were flying at this high school down the way and somebody fell on their knees and prayed in the cafeteria. I wonder if that was a violation of the Constitution. No, I don't want a prayer written. But we have become so ungodly and replaced it with moronic asininity and lie as we tell the people evolution is a fact. It's not a fact. It's a theory based on lies, and they twist the facts to support their lie. And it's time somebody says they're a bunch of damn liars. With this, I'm finished. Studies in flood geology, I'll bring out as we move on now in Romans, and the biblical premise of cataclysms is totally rejected by the scientists who do not want to accept God. Scientists are okay. A lot of scientists accept God. This is written by scientists. Scientism has ruled out God. The Bible begins with a great gap of a cataclysm that struck an earth. Isaiah and Ezekiel make it clear Satan was in Eden before he fell, and he's fallen in Genesis 1, 2 onward. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth became, the Hebrew says was, equally valid, the earth became a waste and a desolation. We know the flood is a cataclysm. Cataclysms have struck this earth, is the biblical position. And Darwinism and evolution had to remove cataclysmic theories, which was in the vogue before Darwin and Lyell and Huxley came along. Cataclysms are the biblical record. I will be on that next Sunday, and flood geology will prove that most of these, if not all of these species, could have been living at the same time. Evolution has no explanation for warm-blooded mammals with food in their stomach from a tropical area buried instantly. The evidence across the earth of mass cataclysm, wiping out whole populations of animal life in a mass so fast that the food's still in their mouth and the stomach is undigested. They don't even have an answer. They have no answer for self-replicating cells. The so-called information theory. They're a dying faith that if Jesus tarries, men will look back and ridicule this attempt by man to explain how we got here without God as one of the most foolish things that ever happened on the face of this earth. And yet it's in the vogue now until to speak out against evolution is to be non-academic. Sorry, I got the credentials and I'm speaking out. And I will carry forward. That's my message to you.